This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, it's crunch time for Brexit. As crucial votes loom for the policy that's torn the UK apart, the man who turned the phrase sees mayhem ahead. And the mother of one of the women now on trial for assassinating a family member of the North Korean leader tells AM her daughter thought she was just working as a reality TV star.
But when she did indeed appear on TV, it was after her arrest for murdering Kim Jong-nam at Kuala Lumpur Airport. She told me that she's innocent. Her mother says she was just there to be in front of the camera, that was all.
Investigations are underway into the baffling crash of an Ethiopian Airways jet, killing all 157 people on board. The plane had taken off from Addis Ababa and was en route to Nairobi in Kenya. It had only been in the air 6 minutes before it crashed. It's the same type of aircraft that came down in Indonesia last October. That plane also crashed shortly after takeoff. Catherine Gregory reports.
Boeing's 737 MAX 800 aircraft is under intense scrutiny now. It's the plane involved in yesterday's Ethiopian Airlines crash, which killed 157 people, and also last year's Lion Air crash in Indonesia, where all 189 passengers died. Aviation experts say the planes need to be investigated. Neil Hansford is the chairman of Strategic Aviation Solutions.
Boeing on this case now has got no choice than to actually fess up. And I think you're going to find major regulatory bodies like the FAA and the European regulators are going to say, right, Boeing, this is it. It's unsatisfactory. What's going to happen? And really grounding in some of those markets. I would think it would be an inevitability.
Already, Indonesian transport officials have been urged to ground all of their Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes. Virgin Australia says it has 30 of the planes on order. None are currently in use. And a Qantas spokesman says there was no official comment, but confirms Qantas does not have any 737 MAX aircraft on its fleet or on order. But Neil Hansford has told RN Breakfast Australian Airlines should not be so concerned.
I would say that an aircraft in the hands of highly trained Virgin or Qantas pilots is not exposed to pilots in other less disciplined environments than Australia. So I wouldn't be concerned if this situation existed in a Virgin aircraft because of the quality of the Australian flight crew. But in other developing markets, I would think it may put tests on the pilots flying that they may well have not been trained adequately for.
Ethiopian Airlines Group CEO Tewolde Gebremariam says the cause of the crash is still unknown. And he says the plane, which was only a few months old, had no known technical problems and the pilot had an excellent flying record.
Ahmed Nur Muhammad Nuri Balan.
The pilot is an Ethiopian Airlines staff member. He has had more than 200 flight hours. After receiving the aircraft, we did the first maintenance check on February 4, 2019, and it was a new and clean aircraft.
But we do know that the Ethiopian Airlines plane went down just 6 minutes after taking off from the capital en route to Kenya. The pilot sent out a distress call almost immediately after the takeoff. And Swedish flight tracking website FlightRadar24 says the plane experienced an unstable vertical speed after takeoff. Air crash investigators and experts from the US National Transportation Safety Board are en route to the site as local excavators search for any remains of the plane. Kenya's Transport Minister James Macharia says dozens of nationalities were involved.
We can now confirm that there were at least 35 nationalities. And I'm saying at least because as of now, two are unknown. So among the most affected, as you may expect, is Kenya, which had about 32 passengers on board.
The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade says there's no information Australians were on the flight, though it's still making urgent inquiries. And relatives of those killed are still trying to come to terms with what happened. Some say they first heard about the plane crash from social media. Robert Mutanda was waiting at the Nairobi airport for his brother-in-law.
We were sure our relative was going to come out. After a few minutes, we saw some news on Facebook, and Twitter just flying Ethiopia Airlines crashes. And when we look at the time, it was the same time he was actually to leave Ethiopia.
And that's relative Robert Mutanda there, and Catherine Gregory was our reporter. If you've heard enough of hearing the word Brexit, imagine how the man who invented it feels. According to the Oxford Dictionary, Peter Wilding was the first to use the term, and now he can't stand hearing it. And like it or not, this week will be crucial, with a string of votes planned in the UK Parliament that will determine whether or not the UK leaves the EU at 11 p.m. on March the 29th, as agreed. From London, our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley compiled this report.
Since September 2017, this man has stood outside the Houses of Parliament at Westminster and on every single sitting day repeatedly shouts this.
Stop Brexit!
It's been a long road, but this week is crucial to how things will play out. MPs will vote for a second time on Tuesday on Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal that was rejected by an historic margin in January. And the Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt has warned if it fails to pass again, there's a real risk the end result will be no Brexit.
If you want to stop Brexit, you only need to do three things. Kill this deal, get an extension, and then have a second referendum. And within 3 weeks, those people could have two of those three things. So we are in very perilous waters.
If the more than 600 MPs in the House of Commons vote against the deal, the following day they'll get a vote on leaving the EU without a deal. If that fails, a third vote on delaying Brexit. For the government, it's a troubling time. Amid warnings, if the Conservatives fail to deliver Brexit, MPs will be judged harshly at the ballot box. David Davis is a former Brexit secretary.
Britain will get its Trump moment. I mean, what happens is that the British people who voted for this, and a large number of Remainers who didn't vote for it but still think it should be carried through because they believe in democracy, will see a government walking away, a parliament walking away from a question that they themselves put to the people.
Well, indeed, Brexit has become a dirty word.
According to the Oxford Dictionary, Peter Wilding is the inventor of the word Brexit, but he can't believe how badly it's all playing out.
So, having invented the word, I see it as a terrible shame.
He predicts the European Union will grant a lengthy delay.
And if they do offer a longer extension, that will cause absolute mayhem in the British Parliament and consequently lead to a completely new story developing the whole Brexit saga.
Perhaps it would be needing a new term, another word for Brexit, Brexit Take Two. Would you be wanting to think of...
Brexiternity.
Brexiternity.
Brexit D-Day is just around the corner, or not, depending on how this week unfolds. This is Samantha Hawley in London reporting for AM.
In Malaysia, the defence begins today for the first of two women charged with murdering Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of North Korea's leader. Indonesian woman Siti Aisyah and Duan Thuy Huong from Vietnam deny charges that they smeared a toxic nerve agent on Kim's face as he walked through the airport terminal in Kuala Lumpur. Lawyers say the two women will give different accounts in their defence, and one lawyer says the two women had never met. Southeast Asia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
At a home in West Java, Ibu Benar gazes at a photo of her daughter, Siti Aisyah, now 27. It's more than 2 years since she left the family home before telling her mother she hoped to become a television star. But when she did indeed appear on TV, it was after her arrest for murdering Kim Jong-nam at Kuala Lumpur Airport. She told me that she's innocent. Her mother says she was just there to be in front of the camera, that was all. Then it turned out that other people had planned something. Siti Aisyah and Duan Thuy Huong will appear in court today for the start of a months-long defence case. The Vietnamese woman, for the first time, will give judges her version of events. Both women deny they're murderers. Both say they thought they were being filmed for a reality TV prank show. And yet one of Siti Aisha's lawyers, Azura Alias, says the pair didn't know each other, they'd never met, and they weren't even working together on the day.
They were not together.
Were they not both caught on camera together?
No, they were not caught on camera together.
But they were in the same area at the same time in the airport, yes?
Yes, but they were not together.
Security vision from the airport purportedly shows two women attacking Kim Jong-nam. Police sources have alleged one of the women sprayed the deadly nerve agent VX on Kim Jong-nam's face as he walked through the airport terminal, while the second woman immediately after held a cloth over his face for 10 seconds. But Siti Aisha's team denies she's one of the two women caught on camera, even though media reports in Malaysia said traces of VX were found on the two women's clothing, and her lawyer, Azura Alias, doesn't deny she was at the airport that day.
Based on the defence that we have put at the prosecution level, we do not deny that they were our client was there.
The different accounts mean the two women will present separate defences. Lawyers for Siti Aisha will cross-examine the Vietnamese woman when she addresses today's hearing, though the Indonesian woman's own defence is unlikely before May. Four North Korean men suspected of orchestrating the murder fled Malaysia soon after Kim's death. Lawyers for the two women are confident both will be acquitted, and Siti Aisha's mother, Ibu Benar, will be in Kuala Lumpur for today's hearing. This is Anne Barker reporting for AM.
And you're listening to AM. It's 11 minutes past 8. Julie Bishop will be replaced by a woman in her safe Liberal seat of Curtin in Western Australia after a bitter pre-selection battle between party power brokers. The candidate Ms Bishop was apparently supporting attracted just a single vote, comprehensively defeated by the Conservative-backed Celia Hammond. The drama was all playing out while Ms Bishop took to the stage in Sydney, where she spoke candidly about the loneliness she felt as a woman in politics. Political reporter Jane Norman was there.
There were no disillusioned voters in this crowd. 2,000 women packed into the Sydney Opera House to hear four female MPs talk about life in politics. And the picture they painted wasn't too rosy.
It can be a lonely place.
After 20 years in Parliament, Julie Bishop has called time on her political career and she's offering some insights on her way out.
You keep very much to yourself as a woman. You don't go out drinking with the boys. Well, you can, but it's just not the same camaraderie. Parliament House is not a family-friendly place.
That's a view shared by Labor's Linda Burney, who, after surviving the bear pit of New South Wales politics, made the move to Canberra.
It is very demanding, particularly if you're a woman, and particularly it is true if you've got a young family. That's the
truth.
That
goes for the men too.
But it doesn't apply to them as much.
MPs spend half the year travelling to and from Canberra. It's still a male-dominated adversarial world. Julie Bishop offered a rather radical way of changing that. Spend less time at Parliament.
It's extraordinary that in this day and age, we have to have physical voting. You have to physically be present
in order to vote. Yeah.
I mean, I was in Ukraine years ago. They have electronic voting in Ukraine.
Yeah.
But ultimately, all of the women agreed it's a cultural shift that's needed. Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young.
Over the years, the behaviour in the chamber has gotten worse. Mm. We cop it the worst as women because there is a specific gendered nature to it.
Yeah.
Let me be very clear about that.
Liberal turned independent Julia Banks has had a lot to say about the way women are treated.
I think I've made it pretty clear that I've moved on from the Liberal Party.
She used the platform to take another dig at her old party, diagnosing what she thinks is the cause of its woman problem.
Yes. So you've got leadership in the Liberal Party saying, looking at women through this prism of the traditional picket fence, whereas the world has moved on.
While she was sitting on the panel in Sydney, over in Perth, Liberal members were choosing Julie Bishop's replacement in the blue ribbon seat of Curtin. Former University of Notre Dame Vice-Chancellor Celia Hammond prevailed. Julie Bishop tweeted her congratulations. A woman won, but not the one she was said to be backing.
Jane Norman reporting there. The New South Wales state election is now less than 2 weeks away, with the major parties launching their campaigns yesterday. Despite the state's strong economy and the government's big spending plans, the coalition risks losing power, with little-known opposition leader Michael Daly so far outmanoeuvring the Premier, Gladys Berejiklian. Political reporter Melissa Clark.
A hard-working Premier in charge of a strong economy with a big infrastructure spend would normally be a winning election formula. But Gladys Berejiklian's coalition government is battling to hold on to power.
Together, let's get it done, New South Wales.
Meanwhile, the opposition leader many in New South Wales don't know or even recognise has changed the game. Labor's relatively new leader, Michael Daly, is experiencing a surge in support.
Labor is united, ready, willing and able to govern. Friends?
It's the unpopular versus the unknown. The contest is proving to be confounding.
This is a really unusual election.
Dr. Andy Marks is a political scientist with Western Sydney University and has been watching the campaigns closely.
You know, you have a government that has a budget in surplus. They have low trending unemployment, one of the strongest and fastest growing economies in the nation. Yet they still can't seem to win a trick.
Gladys Berejiklian's government is promoting major infrastructure projects, but the Premier doesn't seem to be cutting through.
And they really haven't been able to translate to voters how all of this stuff, this construction maze, is really going to make their lives better.
The decision to rebuild two Sydney sports stadiums has become totemic for all the wrong reasons. Gladys Berejiklian didn't mention the stadiums at her campaign launch, at least not directly.
It's difficult to imagine what New South Wales would be like today without the Harbour Bridge or the Opera House or without the Snowy Hydro Scheme. And yet in their time, none of these projects was universally supported or easily delivered.
It's proving to be a hard sell in regional New South Wales, where the election is likely to be won or lost. The usual coalition versus Labor divide doesn't apply. In coastal electorates like Ballina, Tweed and Lismore, the Greens and Independents are in the mix with Liberals, Nationals and Labor. In bush seats like Monaro, Murray and Barwon, the Shooters, Fishers and Farmers and One Nation are gaining traction, which means a minority government is shaping up as the most likely outcome. Dr. Marks again.
We're seeing the challenge to centrist politics worldwide, and that's evident in things like Brexit and the rise of Trump. So the effect of that on humble old New South Wales is that issues that used to be a blip are now, you know, causing a real vault.
That's Dr. Andy Marks from Western Sydney University, ending that report by Melissa Clark. The new regime to provide transparency about foreign influence over the approaching federal election is launched with more of a whimper than a bang. From today, the Foreign Influence Transparency Register begins operations. But so far, just 9 organisations have registered, though. The government expects more to do so. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
The 9 people and organisations who've registered so far are mostly made up of well-known Canberra lobbyists. Norway's claimed the top spot on the list, with 4 lobbyists registering that country as the one they represent. China makes the list just once via resources lobbyist Warwick King. Former Liberal Minister Brendan Nelson's put himself on the register due to his relationship with the French defence contractor Thales. The Attorney General Christian Porter's hopeful the 9 on the list so far are just the starting point.
We've also, in addition to that 9, received almost double that number in what I'd describe as fairly late lodgements, which will be processed in the next several days.
And he expects there'll be more to come after that.
What you will see is a range of organisations who, particularly during election campaigns, accelerate their attempts to influence the democratic process. And you'll see a greater number of registrations.
The register's the brainchild of former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who launched it in December 2017 amid dire warnings from ASIO.
Foreign powers are making unprecedented and increasingly sophisticated attempts to influence the political process.
Though he gave assurances at the time that China isn't the target, the scheme was announced at the height of the Sam Dastyari affair and questions about that country's influence over the former Labor senator.
This will give the Australian public and decision makers proper visibility when foreign states or individuals may be seeking to influence our political processes and public debates.
Christian Porter says even with the list in the single digits, the Register may already be having an impact.
Bob Carr recently resigned from the Australia-Chinese Relations Institute, which is one of those organisations that I think a lot of people might have considered would need to ask itself the question, is it a foreign principle within the definition of the Act?
Last month, former Liberal Trade Minister Andrew Robb resigned from his $700,000 a year job as an advisor to the Chinese company Landbridge, which has a controversial 99-year lease over the Port of Darwin.
Political reporter Tom Eagledon. The future of the Nationals leader and Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormick continues to be the subject of febrile speculation. The man he replaced as leader, Barnaby Joyce, has been speaking this morning on Radio National. And joining me again is Tom Eagledon. And Tom, what's Mr. Joyce had to say this morning?
Well, certainly nothing, Sabra, that would dampen that speculation about his interest in taking the leadership back off Michael McCormack. Now, of course, there are some technical difficulties involved in doing that. We have 3 days just left of this current Parliament sitting, and that is, of course, budget week, so that would present something of a difficulty perhaps for Barnaby Joyce. And that aside, he is certainly not, as I said, doing anything to dampen that speculation. Here's what he told Fran Kelly just a few moments ago.
I am not going to call a spill. I am not looking for numbers. So we just write that. If there was a spill, the position's vacant. I am the elected Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, so I'd have any guilt at all standing, but I don't see that happening. But, you know, people always ask these gotcha questions, and, you know, there is the straight answer. So people say, oh, there's a leadership topple. No, it wouldn't be, because I'm the elected leader at the last federal election.
That's the former Nationals leader there, Barnaby Joyce. And Tom, the government is facing a tough fight. How tough? What's the latest polling suggesting?
Well, there has been, for the 50th time now, not much of a change in the polls. The coalition is still behind, and that would translate into something like a loss of 6 seats, particularly in Queensland, mostly amongst them Nationals. And that is really driving this latest speculation against Michael McCormack's leadership. And the issue here, Sabra, is the issue of coal. They are all saying they want Michael McCormack and the government to go to the election promising to build a coal-fired power station, presumably in Queensland. So this is the issue that Barnaby Joyce, should he put his hand up, presumably he would run on. He has now joined that call from those Queensland Nationals to build this coal-fired power station, Sabra.
All right, Tom, and that polling was in News Poll today. Lake Macquarie, north of Sydney, is Australia's largest coastal saltwater lagoon, and it's teeming with marine life. But past industries and coal-fired power stations have left a toxic legacy, potentially exposing fishermen to dangerous levels of heavy metals. Recent testing by authorities obtained by the ABC has revealed high levels of cadmium in crabs, which can cause kidney damage in people who eat them regularly, yet there's been no significant attempt to warn the public. Ben Millington filed this exclusive report.
Lake Macquarie is a fisherman's paradise, but two fishing spots are surprisingly popular.
There's warm water coming out of that outlet and it attracts the fish, especially during winter time.
Neil Wynn lives next to Vales Point Power Station, one of two ageing coal-fired plants at the southern end of Lake Macquarie. The stations use water from the lake to cool the plants, and areas around the outlets are irresistible to anglers.
It's a very popular area for fishing and crabbing, especially crabbing. People come here just to target the crabs, especially the mud crabs.
But the area is badly contaminated with heavy metals, according to extensive water and sediment sampling done by the local Hunter Community Environment Centre. For nearly two decades, the New South Wales Environment Protection Agency has warned people not to eat more than 2 to 3 servings of fish from the lake a week due to high levels of selenium. Now, new sampling by the EPA shows that not only have levels of selenium in fish failed to decrease, but crab meat contained high levels of cadmium.
The bottom-dwelling organisms are absorbing the cadmium in the sediment to such an extent that it's becoming unhealthy to eat.
Paul Wynn, of no relation to Neil Wynn, is a researcher with the Environment Centre and obtained the results of the EPA's seafood testing under Freedom of Information. The raw data shows the safe number of mud crab servings a week is 0. For blue swimmer crabs, it's 0 for children and 1 150-gram serving for adults per week. But this significantly differs from what was publicly shared at the very bottom of a media release in January.
Dietary advice for cadmium remains consistent, and people can safely consume 6 servings per month of crab meat. And a child under 6 years old can safely consume 3 servings a month.
Paul Wynne.
I find it astounding that the EPA can brush over such an important public health issue. There's some 250 tonnes of sea life that's caught by recreational fishermen in Lake Macquarie, so it's a significant public health issue.
Professor Melissa Haswell is from the School of Public Health at Queensland University of Technology.
This does seem to be a bit of a disjoint between the risk assessment and the recommendation.
Professor Haswell's expertise is studying cadmium in seafood. She says she would be very cautious about eating crustaceans from southern Lake Macquarie.
The concern about cadmium is the fact that our bodies can't really get rid of it. So it accumulates and our kidneys can't excrete it. And people can tolerate a certain amount of cadmium in their kidneys without having health effects. However, if that builds up, it can contribute to renal failure.
Professor Haswell says the EPA also only tested claw meat from crabs, which generally has lower levels of cadmium. She says people with kidney problems, chronic diseases like diabetes, and the elderly are already more vulnerable.
And because cadmium builds up, people who have eaten a lot of these animals in the past may already be at levels that could be concerning.
And that's Queensland University of Technology's Professor Melissa Haswell ending Ben Millington's report. More than 300 scientists have called for a halt to soaring land clearing rates in Australia. Native vegetation protection laws have been relaxed during the past decade in some states. New South Wales and Queensland are considered the worst offenders, leading to Australia now being described as a deforestation hotspot internationally. Lexi Metherill reports.
WWF has singled out eastern Australia as one of the world's 11 land-clearing hotspots. The Wilderness NGO highlights the loss of koala habitat in its deforestation campaign. Scientists say there's also been a loss of habitat for smaller creatures like insects that pollinate plants and kill pests. And Professor Richard Kingsford from the University of New South Wales says land clearing removes vegetation that pulls carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. He's one of 300 scientists to sign a declaration calling for stronger legislation to rein in land clearing.
So Australia's spending $2.55 billion on carbon abatement, and a lot of that money is going into planting vegetation, and that's expensive. The big challenge here is that while we're planting trees, we're also clearing them. And you have to think, that's just not a good use of money.
The main reason land is cleared is for livestock farming. Agforce Queensland's chief executive is Michael Gurin.
Landscapes in Australia have been managed for many thousands of years. The lack of management recently has been one of the reasons for the big fires, we believe, in Australia. But the recent laws, for example, in Queensland, have made environmental outcomes worse by restricting farmers and graziers from managing their lands in the way they've been done for thousands of years. So what has been suggested by these scientists, in our opinion, is plain wrong. It looks to us like it hasn't been peer-reviewed or properly considered.
The Queensland government last year reversed the cuts to native vegetation protection that had been made by the previous government. Professor Kingsford says that's welcome, but there are still problems.
We are still seeing some large areas cleared up in the Gulf Country, particularly for new areas for intensive irrigated agriculture. And I guess, you know, there's concerns about the footprint of mining and the impact that that would have both on biodiversity, but also in terms of the issues around fire and drought.
New South Wales watered down its restrictions on land clearing in 2017, but the state's Environment Minister, Gabrielle Upton, says the incentives for farmers to protect areas of their land improves biodiversity.
I welcome feedback, of course, constructively on the laws, always open to that. But I think these laws strike a good balance between the interests of farmers and, of course, the concern that we have as a community for preserving biodiversity across our state.
But such statements are doing little to ease scientists' concerns that Australia has a land-clearing crisis. Professor Kingsford says the environmental implications are vast.
We increased the number and duration of our droughts, which really then has a vicious circle in terms of increasing bushfire. It's a compelling range of reasons for actually protecting our native vegetation for us, for the economy and for the future.
That's the University of New South Wales Professor Richard Kingsford ending Lexi Metherell's report in finance. It's set to be quiet on the share market today with a public holiday in Victoria, South Australia, Tasmania and the ACT. The major economic events on Wednesday with official data on lending to households and businesses expected to confirm that growth is softening. The Australian dollar is lower this morning. It's trading at 70.4 US cents. That is AM for today. I'm Sabra Lane. It is 8:30.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from The Signal, the ABC's daily news podcast. Every morning we take a deeper look at a big story in the news. Today's ep is all about the latest HIV breakthrough because it looks, for all the world, like a second man has effectively been cured. So why are scientists so reluctant to call it that?
The key to a cure, believe it or not, might actually lie in another disease, which got us thinking, how much do humans actually need disease in order to survive? And are we wandering into an evolutionary cul-de-sac by avoiding sickness? That's The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.